Hello, and welcome to I Am the Eggpod with me, Chris Shaw. The Eggpods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, we are actually in Pepperland, and so it's welcome to author, writer, and host of the excellent nostalgia podcast Looks Unfamiliar, Tim Worthington.
Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm really looking forward to talking about this album, and you have preempted that I was going to jump on that. We are literally taking a stroll through Pepperland joke, so well
I'm
done
sorry
you,
about
you
that.
Beat me to it.
Premature is my middle name. Before we get on to the album, when did you actually first discover the Beatles?
Well, it's an interesting thing, because obviously I'm from Liverpool, and to this day, there are reminders of the Beatles all around. But it's a quite an interesting story, really, because obviously when I was very young, I mean, I remember loving the Beatles cartoon when I may even been before I started school, when ITV used to put them on just after the, I think it was after the midday news bulletin. And I loved that. I remember my parents still had a couple of, I mean, I think, for obvious reasons, you know, starting a family and so on, they bailed on popular culture pretty early, but they had A Hard Day's Night and a couple of the early Beatles albums knocking around. And you heard it everywhere. But the thing was, as I got a bit older, very, very odd, in Liverpool for a while, to a younger generation, the Beatles were about the naffest thing there could be. You kind of associated them with kind of, you know, embarrassing distant relatives at a wedding doing very odd arms akimbo dances to Love Me Do and She Loves You. And it was seen as a very, very, well, naff thing. And the moment it turned around for me, and it's really, really weird that I later found out that Peter Serafinowicz had exactly the same experience. And the odd thing is, we knew each other by sight as youngsters from kind of indie clubs and so on. We didn't know each other at that point. And it was exactly because I was obsessed with Monty Python. I was already obsessed with 60s music, but the Beatles still had that aura of they are the previous generation's thing. We're a bit fed up of being reminded of them, especially when the city is still in kind of a state of decline, really, which it was, you know, in the 80s. The regeneration only really happened at the end of that decade, or even started to happen then. And it was because I was then obsessed with Monty Python when the BBC repeated series 2 and 3. And not long after they finished repeating series 3, they repeated The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash.
Oh, yeah.
Which I was transfixed by. I just recorded it on the off chance that, you know, it had Eric Idle in, it had Neil Innes, who I was vaguely aware of. And the thing that really blew me away about it at that point were Neil Innes' songs. And then I started to think, well, hang on, if these are good, then maybe the Beatles are good as well. And almost secretly, I started to get things like, I got Revolver around then, before, you know, before the real Revolver is the best album thing started, A Hard Day's Night, you know, just slowly started getting the albums. And it was kind of like a dark secret in school, finding people who also like the Beatles. And there wasn't a turnaround for quite a while after that. I mean, Yellow Submarine was an album that got around that point for reasons we'll come back to. But it only really took off in the early 90s when it was the dawn of the Britpop thing. I mean, before that, I remember people saying when I played A Day in the Life to some people, you know, the sort of thing where you go round to your friends on a Friday evening before you're old enough to go out and play A Day in the Life, and people say, was that the Beatles? Because really? They recognised the voices, but did not recognise that song at all. I remember playing when I first started DJing in sort of indie 60s club, playing Taxman and people laughing.
Really?
And then a couple of years later, you could not move for Beatles worship. And the odd thing was tied in with, you know, people go on about, they try to pretend there was a Beatles fixation in the late 80s, early 90s Liverpool indie bands like the Lars and the Stairs, and that horrible term scallydelic, which is a real southern journalist thing. I mean, these people were not scallies. Scallies went to raves and, you know, sold things down the market or whatever. Lee Mathers was not a scally. Edgar Jones was not a scally. And their music kind of recalled things like Buddy Holly a bit more.
Yes.
Sounds nothing like the Beatles. But then that renaissance happened. Everyone pretended they loved the Beatles all along.
It was bizarre, wasn't it? There was footage on the BBC archive thing where they were showing Eric's and the woman on reception was basically slaughtering the Beatles, saying, we don't have those on round here. And it was just that very strange attitude, almost like there was an interview once with David Quantick where he was talking about Monty Python, how, you know, all the kids a couple of years above him, they were obsessed with Python, and he always had a bit of a resentment against them because of that, because he was slightly too young to know it. You know, it's that interim period where you're neither hither nor thither.
Well, there is also that news footage from, I think it's from the early 70s. I could be wrong about this, but I think it's the first meeting of the Beatles fan club in Liverpool. And there's about 3.5 people there. And we're hopeful we'll get more people in time. But that shows what it was like, really. It's very, you know, if something is from your hometown and it's forced into consciousness 24 hours a day, you're going to reject it a bit.
Okay, so the album that you've picked is the Beatles' January 1969 soundtrack album, Yellow Submarine. So why did you pick this one?
Well, I've picked this because I think it's very unfairly treated. To me, when people try to make out it's not a proper Beatles album because Side 2 is by George Martin, I bracket that with when people act as though Relics, the Pink Floyd compilation, isn't a proper album, or Jimi Hendrix's Smash Hits, then they weren't just flung together. They were put out as proper products. Somebody sat down and thought, well, what tracks go on here, what order? And at one point, those albums were all you could get if you were young and poor of those acts. And it's kind of true Yellow Submarine as well. It is a proper... I hesitate to call it a proper Beatles album because half of it is a George Martin album, but then half of every Beatles album is a George Martin album to me. Yeah. So it just fits with that. And I picked it because it's got some of my favourite Beatles songs on, and I love George Martin's score.
You think A Hard Day's Night and Help soundtracks. This soundtrack follows more the format of the US Capitol soundtracks, which always had orchestral scores. And I think that obviously Side 2 is purely George Martin, but I think the key difference with this is, with one exception, these are all George Martin compositions, and he is really in full Technicolor flower power mode on this.
He is, and you get all the benefits of his years of making very strange records. I mean, even long before he worked with the Beatles, he had this incredible history of, I mean, I just made a short list before, and some of the things on it are quite just a bizarre spectrum of things. There's Time Beat, which was basically the first Radiophonic Workshop record, where he took the time signal created by the Radiophonic Workshop for the BBC television service and turned it into a, you know, what you would call a dance record in those days. There's Ringing on the Engine Bell by Bernard Cribbins. Well, all the Bernard Cribbins records, but that one in particular, where he makes the fire bell on the Very Speeded Tape part of the music. He did the Ivor Cutler Trio album, Ludo, which is the closest Ivor Cutler came to a proper pop album, I think, and I think that's George Martin's influence. Experiments with Mice, which is a Johnny Dankworth record where he plays three blind mice in different jazz styles and does comedy bits between them. I mean, that must have took some putting together even before they recorded it. That Was the Week That Was album, which sold in enormous quantities. And it's like a proper addition to the show on an album. And he is listed as a producer. He must have sat down and worked out the script with them. But I think the most important record, and I would wager all of the Beatles, probably including Ringo, owned this, was from 1958, the Peter Sellers album, The Best of Sellers. There's two songs on there which go beyond just taking a comedian in the studio and putting it on record. Well, I say songs, but they're music intertwined with comedy bits. There's a trumpet volunteer, which we'll come back to on one of the songs on Yellow Submarine, where it's a parody of people like Tommy Steele, where he constantly refers to how he's taking all the tunes, well, are just out of copyright by classical composers and putting lyrics to them. This amazing kind of rock and rolled up version of the trumpet voluntary with dreadful cockney lyric over the top. And there's also Anti-Rotter, which I think was written by Bob Monkhouse. It's a parody of Listen With Mother, which is not only is the parody pitch perfect from a script point of view, but there's musical interludes where, you know, they would have had the tinkly piano on Listen With Mother on the Home Service, where George Martin lets rip with these incredible rock and roll riffs on that kind of piano. And I think that really informed, in a weird roundabout way, what he later did with the Beatles. It was a meeting of minds, really.
Absolutely, yeah. And you can hear it's a lot of the songs, obviously, will come to them later, but you can hear then the Beatles' influence on his orchestrations on side two.
Absolutely, yeah.
Also, I definitely recommend George Martin's 1968 album, British Made.
Yes, M-A-I-D. I was going to mention that. I think that's the key to understanding the Yellow Submarine album. For anyone who's not heard it, it's basically a solo album by George Martin where he does a couple of Beatles covers on it, quite radically overhauled, pointing towards what he do on this album. He covers a couple of Procol Harum, Traffic songs and so on. There's the theme for the David Frost Show, which the Beatles, of course, later did when they performed Hey Jude on the David Frost Show. Mm. His launch music from Radio 1 and a very weird track called King's Road Raspberry Parade, which a lot of people will recognise as the theme from the BBC School Holidays Hobbies programme, Why Don't You? But it really is a precursor to Yellow Submarine. It's a great album in itself, and it's linked by kind of wacky sound effects as well.
Yeah.
Kind of little bursts of field recordings and so on, which, again, you know, he'd had years of practice at this. And I, for my money, that's a great album. It's also known as By George and London By George, depending on which budget label have reissued it. And it's never been on CD. I would love to see a proper reissue of that.
Oh, definitely. It is just a beautiful piece of music. As you say, A Whiter Shade of Pale. He's playing at Ichiku Park. Oh, a joy. So let's move to the album itself. And again, it's often forgotten that this actually becomes between the White Album and Abbey Road. So musically, chronologically, it sounds almost like a step backwards. It's almost like they're saying, no, we love psychedelia. We're just going to give it one more go.
Well, that also got it caught up in that thing that really annoys me about the idea of the sanctity of the album. I think that's why it's so dismissed, because it comes after the White Album, when, you know, the album was a thing by then. But people push it further and further back, and I would point to bring Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix into it again. You know, you've got The Piper at the Gates of Dawn and Are You Experience of 67. They are basically 60s pop albums, like the earlier Beatles albums, where for one or two tracks, somebody said, okay, yeah, you know what, you can do what you want on this one. You can do Interstellar Overdrive, you can do Third Stone from the Sun. Everything else on them is, you know, that, don't get me wrong, they're experimental far-out songs, but it is a barrage of 60s pop songs. And both of those acts, they then immediately did proper albums, in inverted commas, immediately after that. Mm. But those albums have been tainted with that because of that. And I think that's what happened to Yellow Submarine here, that it came out at a time when the Beatles were saying, we're all about the album, man.
Yeah. And also, I mean, that probably was the case at the time as well, because Derek Taylor's liner notes are basically a preview of the White Album.
Yes!
Which is quite bizarre. And the US liner notes are even more bizarre, written by Dan David, which is effectively British history from 700 AD. So you've got things like Beowulf, Thane of King, Hygelac, and the Magna Carta leading up to 1968 Yellow Submarine. Very bizarre. Very bizarre.
Well, and also it got mostly, I think, there were a lot of terrible reviews at the time.
Yeah.
Apart from the really interesting one, was in the International Times, Barry Miles gave it a really positive review. Now, probably not a lot of people know who he is, but he was part of the mid-60s art psychedelic scene and a close personal friend of Paul McCartney. He was one of the key writers on the International Times, and he's been a really great rock historian since then, because he doesn't get carried away with things. He tells the facts as they are. And he's one of the few people who's heard Carnival of Light who's talked about it in a knowledgeable sense, compared it to various Frank Zappa tracks and to AMM, who were a free jazz outfit in the mid-60s that McCartney went to see live more than once. And yeah. I think he's worth listening to, and he's worth listening to about this album as well.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines. So we sailed on to the sun till we found a sea of green, and we lived beneath the waves.
So should we start with the album? And first track is Yellow Submarine.
Well, I mean, this is the one I've struggled to find much to say about because it's the song I am most familiar with, really. I mean, to me, it brings back memories of, you know, if you grow up in Liverpool, there are yellow submarines everywhere in some form. I mean, the one that really leaps out to me, it's still around somewhere. When we had the International Garden Festival in 1984, there was a life-size yellow submarine in the middle of a water maze in the shape of the Apple logo.
Wow.
And it had flashing lights inside it and statues of blue meanies and so on. I think some bits of it have gone missing over the years, but it has been moved around in various places. But I just, to me, Yellow Submarine isn't a song so much as it is kind of personal history, which is very weird for a song that's almost like, actually, I'm not going to say it's a nonsense throwaway song, because I think there's nothing throwaway about it at all. It's very carefully composed, very carefully produced. Getting Ringo to sing it was the perfect move. And, you know, I know there are people who say, oh, it's just a silly children's song. Equally, there are people who look for hidden drug messages in it. I think they just had a great idea, and they love doing it. And to me, that's underlined by the fact John is getting carried away at the end when he does those shouts in the last verse. Particularly the mono version, where there's an extra one.
Yeah.
Where he comes in one shout earlier. And Yellow Submarine's great, and for what it's worth, I know a lot of people say they prefer that version with the weird sort of sub-goons intro. I don't like that because it is sub-goons. It's not as good.
Yeah. I think, again, at the time, people would have been feeling a bit shortchanged because the Beatles were notorious for just trying to give as much value on their albums. And, you know, most fans would have had this. It's interesting that obviously, the film itself was released in July 68. This album was released in January 69. And as late as March 69. So they'd obviously taken this on board. They were thinking about doing an EP.
Yeah.
Which would have run at 33 RPM. And it would have had Side A, Only a Northern Song, Hey Bulldog, and Across the Universe, which they still hadn't given to the World Wildlife Fund. And on Side B, All Together Now, It's All Too Much. But I guess the fact that that would have been after the event, way after the event. But it would have been a nice thing to have.
But I think it's telling as well that they were dithering over what to do with Across the Universe. Because, again, that shows to me how the album had taken over. And they were recording all these songs, including some great songs on this album. And just thinking, ooh, it doesn't fit there. What can we do with this? And think about how different an album Sgt. Pepper would be if two of the songs from this and Penny Lane had been on there.
Oh, blimey.
It would, that would complete, you could leave the rest of it on there even, all the other songs, it just would completely change it.
Yeah. Again, what you're saying though, John, he was so keen to get Across the Universe released and it didn't appear on this. So, you know, effectively putting it on the Wild Wildlife Fund album is basically saying, I've got to get this song out there. I want people to hear it in any form. And, it's very strange.
But that, then, unfortunately, we ended up with the David Bowie cover, so.
Bless him. I think it's interesting as well, because the whole film is built on the song Yellow Submarine. I was reading an interview with Heinz Edelman, who was the art director, and he was describing the Beatles' movements in the cartoon. So he was saying, George, John and Paul move at 32 frames a second, while Ringo, the shortest, goes along at 24. George walks like a cowboy, Paul like a confident young executive, John like a showman, and Ringo like a schoolboy Charlie Chaplin. Each of the Beatles is characterised by a well-known part of his personality, naturally. Paul is introduced as a mod Mozart, playing Sirius in a museum. George appears out of a haze of transcendental meditation, the mystical philosophy he popularised. John, author of In His Own Right, emerges from a classic literary creation, Frankenstein, and Ringo is pictured as his inimitable self, wandering winsomely by the shore in Liverpool, as he did in A Hard Day's Night.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, that all makes perfect sense to me, because I'd never thought about the fact they do move at different speeds. Even just imagining the film in my head, that is exactly what happens. And yeah, people underrate this film as well, because it's incredibly, so much thought went into it.
Oh, yeah.
My memories of it mainly as a child are, it would be the sort of thing that came on, you know, on a weeknight when you weren't really allowed to stay up. And it was kind of a badge of honour in our family. How long have you been allowed to stay up to see?
Yeah.
But there's so much more to it than just a family filler film for the evenings.
Oh, yeah. The casting as well. I always think, and you pointed on it, with George Martin's connections, I really believe the Goons should have voiced Yellow Submarine. And I'm thinking John could have been played by Spike Milligan, Paul by Peter Sellers, George Michael Bentine, Ringo Harry Secombe, and Sellers and Milligan could do the Blue Meanies and everybody else. That would have been awesome.
That would have been fantastic. Although what I'm getting in my head now is the Radio 3 presentation of Up Against It, the unproduced Joe Orton Beatles screenplay, which kind of sounded like a weirdly updated Britpop Goons thing crossed with The Prisoner.
Yeah. Slightly more obscene.
Yes.
If you're listening to may think the chords are going wrong, but they're not. He just wrote it like that.
Track 2, Only a Northern Song.
Well, this is a key Beatles track for me, because it's one that I use. I mean, this is amongst my, I would say, top 5 Beatles songs, which really makes it weird for me when people are so down on it. And I use it as kind of, I've got a test I do. If there's a book about, you know, the 60s or rock music or whatever that I'm not sure about buying, I have a test where I look in the index and my three things are, if I look up Syd Barrett and it basically just says he took a lot of drugs and went mad and then Pink Floyd got better, I put it straight back down. If it's a Bowie one and they're sneery about Tin Machine, it's a two-line write-up, or about, you know, one of the 90s albums, put it straight back down. Beatles, if they're dismissive of it's only a Northern song and it's all too much, that's it. There's nothing in there that I'm going to want to read.
It's so gone.
You know, and don't get me wrong, there are good books that make that mistake as well. But if it's you know, middling prospect, I'm going to base it on that. I love Only a Northern Song, and I remember seeing, I can't even remember what Beatles book it was, but I put it back down because the description described it as G-pedal monotony. Now, what even is that? Apparently, I looked it up, the G-pedal is an organ-style effect pedal for the guitar, which might not even have existed when this was recorded. Right. And George played a Hammond organ on this, not a G-pedal, whatever it is. And there might not even be any guitar on it at all. I'm not sure, because it is.
No, it's not.
Wall of wailing, discordant noises with this great song underneath it all. I mean, it is, again, it's George Harrison singing about money, and how many of his songs are about money?
Oh, yeah.
And it just makes me think about, I think it was in Select in the early 90s, there was a kind of cartoon of Paul McCartney's head in the style of, you know, the numbskulls, that strip. Was it the Beano or the Dandy, where it had people controlling various bits of, quote, bloke's head, where, you know, it's the eye department, tongue department. So I think the voice department was Elvis Costello with a copy of Learn Yourself Scouse and the Whitbread Book of Scouseology and a megaphone. But it had the back of his mind with a pinned up note saying, G. Harrison owes me 10 bob from 1961. And that kind of says it all. But it is whereas Taxman, kind of, people sometimes claim it's a little bit entitled and whiny, and I can see their point. With this, he's just kind of resigned to the fact that he's locked in a contract with Northern Songs, and they expect a certain amount of songs, I suppose, per month, and Yeah, again, that's parodying the Ruttles with Dick Jaws, isn't it? Played by Barry Cryer, who signs them up forever. And, you know, they take a substantial amount of his money, and he's basically just saying, it doesn't really matter what I write here. The arrangement stays in place and fulfilling it. But there's so much more to it. It's only an Auden song, than just being a time-wasting joke. I think it's tremendous. And I don't hold much weight in this theory itself, but some people have speculated that some of the sounds in the background may come from Carnival of Light. Now, I'm not sure they do, but I mean, it's you know, the very fact that people would think that about this song shows it's a bit more interesting than people say, oh, it makes you fall asleep. Well, what does Within You Without You do then?
Yeah, I'm not sure about it. I know Paul McCartney's on trumpet, which is just amazing. I think years later when they produced the song track version, George was a bit dismissive about the trumpets.
Well, I think it's key that, as far as I can tell, this was recorded just after the final mono mixdown had been done of Sgt. Pepper, which I assume was done before the stereo. I've not actually looked that up, but that was generally the way it was done in those days. But I think there's a pronounced influence in this of, there's a Pink Floyd song from the Piper at the Gates of Dawn called Flaming, which they really closely based on AMM, who I mentioned earlier. And, you know, basically took what AMM were doing and turned it into a proper song. And, you know, there's bird song in it, there's tinkling, there's whistles, there's the wind rushing, all mixed in with their instruments. And I think that had a direct influence on It's Only an Auden Song.
It's a soundscape is amazing. It's like a dark fairy tale.
And, well, the graphics are quite dark that go with it in the film as well. It changes visual tack completely. You get those kind of visually discordant portraits of them sort of whizzing around the screen like it's a wee fit kind of mind-balancing puzzle that you're supposed to, you know, swivel your hips in the direction of George to win points. But that's for that sequence, it completely changes and then it goes back again.
Yeah, that's the sea of science, isn't it?
Yes.
And you can help me here. I'm sure I remember seeing this on an old episode of Blue Peter or Tomorrow's World. It was in black and white, but it's where there was a spinning square, a spinning cube, and there was somehow, it was broadcast in black and white, but you could see the colour green. It was an optical illusion, and that's used in here. But do you know any more about that?
Yes, well, they did do some experiments of that. I mean, quite why, I don't understand, because colour TV was on the way, and, you know, I think it'd already been developed in America by then. But they did try a few things, and I think that's how you get that weird thing now, where they can take episodes of Doctor Who that were originally recorded in colour that now only survive as black and white film prints, that due to that process, kind of have the... I'm simplifying it a lot here. It's not 100% due to the same thing, but it's the same principle that they've got the colour sort of locked into the black and white, and that can be extracted and recovered and restored to full colour. So we do have something to thank that spinning cube for.
Poor old George as well. I mean, this was... originally it was recorded 13th and 14th of February, so it was during Pepper. Final overdubs were on the 20th of April. But obviously, that was turned down for that. And George Martin said the songs that were chosen for Yellow Submarine Movie were the dregs of their inventory, pieces that they would, in any case, jettison, junk, file and forget pieces. So it's pretty harsh on George.
Well, was he just hitting back? Because with the exception of Paul, who I think, you know, probably quite liked Side 2, they were all scathing. John Lennon in particular called it shit more than once. Which is, leave off, mate. You wrote one of the tunes that's on it. So, you know, and also, what does it matter anyway? Personally, I know that everyone listening is going to agree with this, I find it more listenable than the Plastic Ono Band. And I'm not somebody who, you know, shies away from that side of music. You know, you want to take a look at my record collection. But I much prefer Yellow Submarine to a lot of John's solo stuff.
I love you. Boom, 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 boom. Sail the ship. Boom, boom, boom. Chop the tree. Boom, boom, boom.
Track three, All Together Now.
Right, well, I used to hate this when I was younger. I used to find it really annoying. I mean, I don't like the way people have reclaimed it and said it's like Yellow Submarine. It's not like Yellow Submarine. It's not as well thought out. It's not as catchy. The lyrics aren't as clever. But I quite like it now, and they don't mind it sort of way. I find the harmonica really annoying. I mean, they should have... let's be honest about this. Between them all, their harmonica playing was always extremely rudimentary. It wasn't quite Rhapsody in Blue or the Midnight Cowboy theme. They ought to have left that behind with the music they were doing that suited it in the early days, where they needed that basic thing. And, you know, they're a bit more proficient than Dylan, I'll say that. Again, that's going to get you letters, but...
You can tweet at Tim Worthington.
But it's kind of a throwback to that, and that really jars with me. But I've read in a couple of places that George Martin wasn't in the studio for it, and it was Jeff Emmerich, really, who took the reins.
Yes,
George might have curbed it in a bit.
Maybe. I always think it sounds very much like the Beach Boys' Party. That kind of
It does actually, yeah. Or the other thing it reminded me of was, I don't know how many people listening will have heard this, but the Charles Manson album.
Oh dear.
That he recorded with all his hangers on, where they're basically just clapping along and banging pots and pans and singing not very well along to what he sings. I know the Beatles tried to avoid that association by then, but it did remind me of it. But I've got to say, I don't mind it now. And I love it when it speeds up at the end as well. I think they really handle that brilliantly. It's just that harmonica really gets to me.
Well, you can't help but get carried away with it. And again, it's clearly a children's song. It's not attempting to be anything else. But Paul was saying he originally wrote a similar song called Jumping Around the Room. And he said for younger members of the family. So again, I'm wondering if it's Ted and Kate Robbins, because they would have been around.
I really want to hear that now, because I love the idea of Paul singing about jumping around the room.
Yeah. Apparently, he'd sing that, and then it'd be lying on your backs, then I'd have to lie down, then it'd be skipping around the room.
He kind of invented Superman by Black Lace.
And John, I love his comment on this. I put a few lines in it somewhere, probably.
Can I take my friend to bed? Which jars with the rest of the song. Even as a kid, I kind of found that a bit creepy.
Yeah.
You know, it spoils the whole song for me. So that's his line as far as I'm concerned. And also, you wouldn't know from the performance that he wasn't into it, because he's shouting along with the rest of them.
Of course he is, yeah. It's also very similar to the Christmas Time Is Here Again.
It is, yes.
When you've got on Christmas Time, where they're singing, ain't been round since you know when. They should take it in turns. And the same thing with this, All Together Now.
There is that odd history of all the stuff they did on the Christmas albums, which are kind of accomplished comedy songs that are just made up on the spot. I mean, I love that. The folk music pastiche, plenty of jam jars. Yeah. And if you heard as well, when they're on Kenny Everett's last weekend show on Radio 1 before he moved to a weekday slot, and they just start improvising this song, which again actually sounds a bit like All Together Now, that goes, goodbye to Kenny Everett, he is our very pal. They were adept at doing these little comedy doodles.
Yes.
And it's a shame that they didn't do more of them, B, they aren't better known, because... they try to hide the Christmas records these days. There are a couple of reasons for that. Because people don't understand context anymore. But, you know, that's an argument for another day.
Track four, Hey Bulldog.
Well, this is interesting because I love... who doesn't love Hey Bulldog? It's tremendous. But when you kind of know a bit more about the wider world of 60s music... I mean, when was it actually recorded? Because it's a bit like the Beatles are behind the curve a bit. It's like the sort of thing that people like The Eyes were doing in 1965, 66.
February 68.
Right. So, you know, you'd already had a couple of years of these bands that didn't come within... a million miles of the charts, but they kind of let's not pretend otherwise. They were influenced by what the Beatles were doing, and they went and amped it up in the psychedelic clubs. But they were doing this sort of thing in, you know, 65, 66. And this is the only time that the Beatles really came close to that style and sound, I think, apart from maybe, arguably, the Sgt. Pepper reprise. I think what's telling to me about this is, I mean, I'm not saying it's quantitatively better, but personally I preferred, there was a cover released very shortly after the Yellow Submarine film came out. I'm not 100% sure whether it was before the album or not. I've tried to work that out, and it's one of those things that's beyond pinning down the actual date to, but the Gods, who were kind of a late psychedelic band, early prog, they were kind of on the cusp between the two. They did a cover of Hey Bulldog, which is a bit heavier, but also a bit more like something that would have been in the charts. Like, say, Davy Dozy, Beaky Mick and Titch or somebody. And it's got kind of pop trumpets on it. Brilliant. And I actually, personally speaking, you know, I'm not saying the Beatles are not as good as the Gods. That's a ridiculous proposition, especially if you've heard To Samuel the Son, which is one of the albums I struggle with the most in the 60s, because it's a little bit pompous. But I actually prefer that, and maybe that's because in my perspective it is a little bit like the Beatles playing catch up.
I think John later said it's a good sounding record that means nothing. So again, it's, you know, what George Martin was saying, it's just one of these that thrown away at the bottom of the pile, dug out again for this project. But it's,
well, that's ridiculous, because it should have been a single. It really should have been. You know, and I'm not surprised. I mean, there's a whole history of, I mean, I'm actually working on something for my site about that at the moment, which may be published by the time this goes out. But so many bands spotted things that the Beatles had done as a B-side or an album track or whatever that was not going to be a single, and did their own take on it. Like, have you ever heard Tomorrow Never Knows by The Mirage?
Yes, I have.
With a lovely close harmony version of it. Yeah. All kinds of things like that. There's The Young Ideas with a Little Help from My Friends, which, it's a nice rendition of it. It's a world away from those showbiz renditions that you get. You know, there's all those things. So I'm not surprised that, you know, a band heard that and thought, we should have a go at making that into a hit. But the Beatles should really have done that first, on the back of the film as well. But they cared so little about the film while it was in production that it probably didn't even occur to them.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm just thinking what a nice thing it would have been after Lady Madonna. As soon as they headed off to India, they could have released Hey Bulldog and Across the Universe as a double A-side. That would have been lovely. Nice summer song.
I wonder how the Maharishi would have regarded it.
Next we have track 5, It's All Too Much.
There have been times when I've thought It's All Too Much is actually my favourite Beatles song, which will make sense when I think this is the closest they got to sounding like, well, Hendrix or early Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
It's much looser than pretty much any other Beatles song up until that point. It's very undisciplined. They're clearly just playing how they feel. There's a lot of feedback in it, which is probably the Hendrix influence. There's odd things like George starts singing Sorrow by the Merseys towards the end. There's the, well, as we mentioned before, there's a quote from The Trumpet Voluntary by Purcell, which I think was probably George Martin put that in there. But and it's not even the full recording.
No.
It goes on even longer. And I think it justifies that length. I mean, you know, there are songs that are long just because nobody could stop the people involved playing. Things like this, where they're having so much fun singing too much and clapping.
Yeah.
That it's kind of, I would put that on a par with the end of Hey Jude. It's the same sort of thing.
And absolutely.
It's the only occasion on which you can imagine the Beatles sort of getting bored recording Sgt. Pepper, going down to the UFO club, just coming out amongst all the flashing lights, all the dry ice, booting the Crazy World of Arthur Brown off stage and doing this for, you know, 12 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, have you ever heard the Moves live album?
No, I haven't, no.
Something Else by the Move, which is, it's covers, but it's kind of eclectic covers. They cover things, you know, they cover bands like Love and Spooky Tooth and so on.
Okay, yeah.
But it's what I imagine the Beatles would have sounded like live had they gone back on that vow to stop performing live and just gone into the London clubs at that point.
Mm.
I would. That is one of my dream things, imagining what that would have sounded. That's up there with the first take of Take a Giant Step by the Monkees, where they all played the instruments that Davey sang, which no longer exists. I mean, that is just like an alternate universe thing that I would love to hear.
I agree. I think the longer version is an astonishing... You've got the extra verse in there as well.
Yeah.
Which also appears in the film.
In the film, yes. I noticed that when I was really young. I was remember thinking, hang on, that bit's not on the record.
And that is one of the highlights of the film as well, isn't it? It's just this... It is perfect visuals for this song.
Yes, because it's just those kind of psychedelic portraits of the assembled characters in the film. Blue Meanies, Pepperland Residents and Beatles all together. And Jeremy usually front and centre in all of them.
Yeah.
But what it always reminds me of, though, is on one of the early DVD releases of it, one of the American-only ones, the Region 1 ones, which you had to pay a fortune for and have a multi-region player. Remember those days? But there's a commentary by, so long ago now that I can't remember, I think it's Al Brodax, who was the producer, director and co-script writer, where I think it's him, and they refer to the fact that, you know, the rays of light in the background, the shifting colours?
Oh, yeah.
That they were done with strips of sellotape. But because it's a brand, and he's American, he's referring to it as cello tape. Which sounds more like something George Martin would have deployed in the studio, really.
I think,
but again, you get all those contrasting bits of visuals in the film, which it isn't really given credit for. It doesn't stay on one style of the four Beatles sloping along at different speeds. It goes all over the place.
Yeah, because John Coates, who was the production supervisor, you forget the film was rushed. It was really rushed, and it was done in within a year, and they were getting late on schedule, so he arranged for a bus to go out every evening and picking up kids from local art schools to finish off the colouring and tracing. So the people would do it in the day, they'd finish, the bus would go out, and then they'd get local art students to carry on colouring in the evening shifts.
And a lot of people who worked on it as well were people who worked on the cartoon.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, revisiting those in recent years, I mean, there are things about it, like, as somebody who grew up within, you know, almost a literal stone's throw of Penny Lane, the episode based on Penny Lane, where they uncover some robbers who were going to rob Penny Lane, and it's got kind of big wrought Victorian iron gates at the end of Penny Lane, so it does make me laugh. But some of those are great little funny stories with great animation in as well. And they use the songs really effectively. And it isn't as big a leap from those to the film as people seem to think. But again, that's partly down to the Beatles, who they've never really commented on the cast. In fact, I think they're quite warm about it in Anthology.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been out of circulation for so long, the whole series, because I think Apple bought the rights in the early 90s and it disappeared. I mean, obviously, you know, you can look online and see bits of them here and there, shall we say, but it's the unavailability of it that's made its reputation dip. And it's a bit more than just, you know, because I remember very vaguely remember the Osmonds and Jackson 5 cartoons, which were kind of, you know, oh, they're popular. Let's just put them in a cartoon. Let's draw them instead of Snagglepuss or something. But the Beatles one, it was made by people who were high on Beatlemania, I think. And the film was possibly made by people who were high for other reasons. Nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say but you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. No one you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do but you can learn how to be you in time. And the final track on side one is All You Need Is Love. Well, I think All You Need Is Love is a song that's been shorn of its context a bit, because, you know, it's kind of a footnote that you say, so say it was part of that Our World broadcast. But that was a massive thing at the time, you know, the first ever global international TV link-up, and the Beatles are front and centre of it. I mean, it kind of knocks the Spice Girls launching Channel 5 into a cocked hat, really. It was a massive achievement at the time. And they obviously rose to the challenge. They were clearly thinking, you know, what's our message at the moment? Despite the fact that we are almost punching each other in the studio, it's all you need is love. And that's what we need to communicate to everyone. And that's, it's kind of a mirror image to Only a Northern Song, in that it's bits of all kinds of things meshed together, but in a structured way that really works.
Yes.
I don't think John singing She Loves You out of tune was as spontaneous as people think. I'm fairly sure, based on the Christmas records, they worked that out in advance.
Okay.
And it's a song that I think it's got quite a thin sound. That's my only problem with it. It's very trebly. There's not much lower register to it at all. But these days, does that really matter? We've got so much more sophisticated listening equipment that you don't notice that in the same way as you did on your terrible Goodman's Walkman when you were 14, trying not to let people in school notice that you had the Beatles on it.
And I think in the actual movie, this, you know, the lyrics of All You Need Is Love, the actual premise of the film is more from All You Need Is Love than it is from Yellow Submarine.
Absolutely. I mean, and if that's the message that people took from the Beatles, well, maybe we should listen to them a bit more.
Yeah. And we're going in. Side two. Originally, George Martin had recorded his film score at Olympic Sound Studios, but he wasn't happy with the recordings. So on 22nd and 23rd of October in 68, he re-recorded everything in Studio One at Abbey Road while conducting a 41-piece orchestra. And the whole thing was completed in 2 3-hour sessions. So we start with track one, Pepperland.
Well, before we go on to that, I just want to bring something up, which is a long, long time ago, Record Collector magazine, which was a huge influence on my musical tastes way back when, had a long-running feature called The A to Z of British Psychedelia. And when they came to G, one of the entries was the George Martin Orchestra, concentrating on side two of this album, with a write-up that basically said, if you've ignored this because it's not the Beatles, the joke's on you, because you're missing out on some of the best British psychedelia there ever was. And I think it's true. And I think Pepperland kind of makes it clear just how much influence George Martin had on the Beatles in the studio. Because to me, as well as being a lovely, sumptuous tune, it sounds like, you know when you get the things with the isolated strings on Anthology? Eleanor Rigby in particular, it reminds me of those. And that's George Martin's side of the equation. And it's absolutely just laid out here for the world to see. This is what he brought to the Beatles. And you might not like it, but then why do you like the Beatles songs that he does these sort of things to?
And his sense of melody is, you know, up there with McCartney.
Well, I mean, there's one of my favourite Beatles-related things, which is kind of written out of history, was from Paul's experimental phase in the mid-60s, when they... I mean, I get shot down whenever I say it was a collaboration, but technically it was a collaboration between Paul McCartney and George Martin, in that they did, in a roundabout way, work together on the score for a film called The Family Way. I love that soundtrack album. Yes. I think it's fantastic. And it shows that Paul was listening to, you know, all these odd little Baroque quartets and so on. Yeah. And early music, I think, creeps into it a bit. And I think they were the most, well, harmonious on that side of things. I think they understood each other. I'm surprised that Paul has never covered the Pepperland theme in some form. Because it is like something. that he would have done later. Yeah. No, it's not that far from the Frog Chorus, really. I mean, you might take that as a criticism if you want. To me, that's high praise. But it's a lovely, lovely little tune that suits the visuals perfectly. And I love the way it builds at the end into that real sort of golden age of Hollywood climax.
Yeah.
Where you get all those unexpected chord changes and that lovely swell at the end.
Yes, yeah. Again, I'm wondering if Phil Spector could have heard this, thinking, yep, that's what the Beatles like. That's what I'm going to do on Long and Winding Road.
How do I take this and not do it any good at all? But there you go. You've got the contrast between it's people like Phil Spector that are celebrated, where, you know, they wanted to be stars as much as the people they're making the records with. George Martin, Joe Meek, the people from the Radiophonic Workshop, they were just... they saw it as a day in the office, almost. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, they wanted to have successful records or successful TV themes or whatever, but it wasn't about putting yourself out there. And while there is a kind of thing now about how dry and not in a witty sense George could be in interviews, I think it's just a reflection of his modesty.
Yes,
he never made great claims for anything. He seemed to... have as much fondness for things like the Mahavishnu Orchestra and America and so on, and other people he worked with, Cilla Black, as he did for the Beatles. Because he had this whole massive long career where he worked with different people all the time. I mean, probably he did some, you know, he did the bulk of a Beatles album in one morning, and then spent the rest of the day with, I don't know who else, Roy Kinnear or sort of Lance Percival or somebody doing a comedy record. And it is just modesty, really. That prevented him from saying anything high-flown or controversial, apart from slagging off the new songs of Yellow Submarine.
The one key thing they learned from George was that the music came first.
That's absolutely it. I mean, like I say, there's another ridiculous idea about the 60s that, you know, there were one or two people who were just being artistic for the sake of it. Everyone wanted to hit records, and don't you kid yourself otherwise.
Mm.
You know, you get even bands like American bands like Love had one eye on what would work on the radio. And its cult status gets conferred on people later. I mean, you look at... people forget Scott Walker's solo albums topped the charts. But now they're seen as, you know, these weird aberrations. But they were bought by teenagers, you know, who fancied him. No, it's later that it became a thing where, you know, only artistic purity mattered. And that's how a lot of... perfectly decent bands in the 60s have been forgotten. I mean, how much do you hear now about Davey Dozy, Beaky Mick and Titch? And they were as big as any of the Beatles' rivals. And they did some really odd, interesting singles as well.
Yes.
But because they weren't, you know, because they were, they called themselves silly names.
Yeah.
And they probably jumped about on Crackerjack a bit to sell a few more records. Yeah. Nobody really cares.
Track two, Sea of Time.
Well, Sea of Time just confirms my sort of statement about it being a collaborative process between George Martin and the Beatles, because this is based on Within You, Without You.
Yes.
And, you know, which gets painted as George Harrison experimenting with Indian devotional music. Well, yeah, he did in writing the song and learning the sitar, but the arrangement, the rest of it, the strings and so on, as emphasised here, is George Martin.
Yeah.
He made that into... you know, a good album track that could have become like things like the tapes of John Cale with Lamont Young in the early 60s, which was just drones. You know, it could have been like that. I would not put it past George to have been wanting to do that, you know, for the sake of, well, artistic purity. But it's George Martin who anchors it, and that's expanded on here. Although that's only the first half of it. It goes to some more flowery, sort of pastoral bit, which reminds me, really, really reminds me of a flop single from the late 60s by a kind of pop folk singer called Timon, called The Bitter Thoughts of Little Jane, which had a very similar string arrangement. If you've never heard that, anyone listening to this, go and look for it on YouTube. It is one of the best singles of the 60s. You will not regret listening to that. ¶¶
the bitter thoughts of little Jane are locked away and will remain unspoken. Been let down and kicked around, been sent away without her token. But she'll find her place, she'll find her head to pound on.
And I wonder if George had heard that, because George Martin rather than George Harrison, who... Well, I've got no idea whether he would have heard it or not. He probably would have done a funny rhyme about time on, but, you know, because Principal Skinner, you've been called the funny one. But it's the two halves, really, of British psychedelia.
Yes.
In one track. And it shows that George Martin, he might have been the square, but he was aware of what was in the pop charts. And well, this is course, him meshing the two together, really. And it's a lovely kind of compact version of the two extremes of Sergeant Pepper as well. It's much shorter than Within You Without You, I'll say that as well.
And as you say, I mean, George's credentials for composing psychedelic music were already proven with the original Radio 1 theme, Theme 1.
I love Theme 1. It is fantastic piece of music.
Which, you know, some of the string arrangements he would later use in I Am the Walrus.
Of course, yeah, I'd never made that connection before, but you're absolutely right. And, you know, what? Again, that shows how important George Martin was. The BBC launched the first ever national pop station, the first ever legal one as well. You know, people go on about Flowers in the Rain, rightly being the first record played on it. But who does the theme, who does the intro music of the whole station? George Martin. That's who they pick. That's who, and he wasn't particularly young or hip or with it. He was just the most important name in pop music. And it's a tune that's basically saying to people, hello, this is over here and you can't do anything about it. It's an unstoppable piece of music. Again, it is on by George / British Made, so another reason to reissue that on CD. A lot of people might have heard that and not realise, because it was on. Do you remember in the mid-90s, there was a series of compilation albums called The Sound Gallery, which kind of on the back of, on tied in with Britpop, you got that wave of easy listening revival.
Oh, yeah.
Or loungecore, as people called it at the time, which, you know, because it wasn't about it wasn't about like crooners and things like people like Chris Evans made it into. It was about finding funky library records and, you know, odd things on soundtracks at first. But on at the end of the second one, the Sound Gallery 2, it's got Theme 1. I think that's the only time, unless it was on the Produced by George Martin box set, which, given there's about 200 discs in that, and some of them are like Birdsong and so on, it could be on that, I'm not sure, but I think that's the only time that's been on CD. And that is a crying shame, because that is a tremendous piece of music. And again, I think that feeds into It's All Too Much.
Oh, definitely.
The overdriven organ is definitely... which is something that hadn't really, in that particular style of organ setting and playing, hadn't really featured with the Beatles before then.
Aside from George's Within You Without You, you've also got the pastoral scene as well, but there's also elements of Holst in there. It just veers within a few minutes throughout all these genres.
Yes, well, there's a much bigger Holst reference coming up later, so obviously... George was, you know, while everyone else was listening to A Saucer Full of Secrets and Axis Boulder's Love, you know, with their suspicious bits of paper being rolled up, George was sitting at home listening to his Holst going, this is rather far out, man.
Oh,
Track 3, Sea of Holes.
This is where it starts to get a bit weird. There's the backward harp on it and a lot of echo and so on. One thing I noticed listening to it in preparation for this is there's very little instrumentation actually going on. It's like random plucks, random drones. It's all in the effects. It's made this massive, in places sinister sound out of a couple of noises and a lot of studio trickery. And again, that's kind of what he brought to the Beatles. But it perfectly suits the, you know, the bit of the cartoon, they're jumping in and out of the holes and finding different things in this.
Yes.
And the weird plunking and so on really does emphasise that. In, you know, it was a sequence that other people might put comedy music on top of. And George just puts this odd, really odd stuff over it.
He recorded a lot of this to a click track, because obviously it had to match to the film. So 35mm film runs at 24 frames a second. So that was effectively his click track, and doing all of these random, you know, orchestral swells and whatever. It's what a man.
And it will all have been very carefully scored as well. And that's something I'm coming back to on a later track. But he would have sat down with his manuscript and a fountain pen and written this all out by hand. Imagine that. And I would love to see those sheets, because one thing I've seen one page of, which just made my heart absolutely thump, was part of Freddie Phillips' score for Trumpdom for the Fireman music. Written out by hand.
Wow.
With even the buzzing of the fire bell on it. Pew, pew, Barney McGrew, Cuthbert, Dibble, Grub. When you see something like that and think it had a genesis, it had somebody sitting down thinking.
Yes.
That casts things like this in a very different light. And while the story of, you know, how the Beatles came up with ideas for songs has been endlessly told, often in wildly conflicting versions. Often it's the same Beatle telling conflicting versions as well.
Yeah.
Nobody really talks about where the ideas for things like this came from. I mean, where did he come up with the idea for theme one from? What was that based on? I'd love to know that.
Yeah. There was nothing like it before.
No.
Even from the Beatles. Track 4, Sea of Monsters.
Sea of Monsters is even weirder, and, well, I said I was going to come back to the score. I can't quite remember exactly what it was, but something like, he made a reference once on something I heard on the radio when I was a kid to, he'd written the score backwards. He'd written it forwards and wrote it out backwards to get the right kind of sucking up sound forward.
Yeah, I think
so. He had to use backwards tape as little as possible, probably due to the constraints of recording, really, and available studio time. But that sounds all the more effective for it, because things sound like, because there's a vacuum monster that appears in the Sea of Monsters who sucks up things in time to this, and it does have more of it. It's not an obvious kind of fake vacuuming sound. It's like a trumpet being played, as though somebody's sucking in rather than blowing while they're doing it.
Yeah. That's exactly why he did it. He scored about 45 seconds of orchestra, but turned it backwards, and you do get that sucking in noise. I think it was a trombone and a cymbal. But that character, the sucking monster, was actually John's idea. Because I think Al Brodax was asking them for ideas, and that was originally called Horace the Vacuum Cleaner, which is lovely.
And you suspect that Horace the vacuum cleaner had a history with John Lennon, that somewhere there was some backstory you've never seen about a poem he wrote about him with all his gnarly friends or something along those lines. You know, that he didn't just pluck that name out of thin air.
No.
He'd conceived Horace the vacuum cleaner before that. And I want to know more now. In fact, do you wonder if he actually drew a sketch of it?
I wonder. He would have, wouldn't he?
Mm. And then was the character based on that?
Yeah.
But that's just part of the Sea of Monsters, because there's a number of quotations in it from... I mean, the first thing I'll say is it starts with a real up-to-the-minute flanging guitar effect.
Yeah.
The sort of thing that people like Hendrix were only just starting to use.
Yes.
But then you get bits of the Sea of Time melody, which I think corresponds with some of the creatures reappearing. You've got... There's a weird little mariachi bit in it, which seems a bit out of place until you realise that in 67, 68, the pop charts were full of things like, well, Legend of Xanadu by Davey Dozy, Beaky McIntitch, Alone Again All by Love, you know, Scott Walker again, there's a lot of mariachi in his stuff, and it was a thing at that point.
Yes.
And so he was obviously just alluding to that.
And that was the scene where Ringo's on the horse, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes! Yeah, because Ringo's not really reminiscent of mariachi sounds, is he? Well, I'd love to hear him cover that song from the start of the episode of Breaking Bad, though.
Yeah.
And then, right at the end, the quote from the Bark Air on the G-String from the Hamlet adverts, where you get one of the monsters lighting up a cigar, which is a weird little musical joke of the sort that the film doesn't do elsewhere, and George Martin didn't tend to do elsewhere.
Yes.
And I wonder whose idea that was, and was it... Did the music come first or the animation come first?
Well, George, the animation, I think, came first. George would have seen that and he would have come up with that joke.
But then you do get that lovely thing where another monster sort of collides down and the quotation sort of breaks down and goes, do, 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 do.
Yeah.
Just his mastery of things like that, it just isn't celebrated enough.
Yeah. Originally they had sound effects and George Martin's score would... You know, they played that against that, and sometimes they'd actually lose the sound effects and use George Martin's score as a sound effect. It was that precise.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Track 6, and some of the regular listeners may recognise this, but March of the Meanies.
Well, I said we were going to come back to Holst, and this really nods towards Mars the Bringer of War.
Yes.
But I don't think it was specifically just a Holst quotation. I think it was informed by... I mean, the Quatermass serials, the BBC ones, the last one wasn't even 10 years old by that point. And they were introduced by Mars the Bringer of War. You know, and I think when the BBC did TV 50 in 1986, where they celebrated 50 years of television broadcast, Ringo was on that, talking unusually eloquently for, you know, how you'd associate him with these days, about watching Quatermass and how terrified he was of it as a kid. And I think he mentioned he had to go round to a friend's house to watch it, and he would be petrified walking back. Yeah, any sudden movement, he thinks somebody was going to come up to him and, you know, touch him like in Quatermass 2 and affect him. And that would still have been looming large in people's minds. And I think it was a nod to that because this is a really nail-biting piece of music.
Oh, it is, and
one thing that I would like to point out here is there is this idea that, you know, the blue meanies are blue because blue is the colour of conservatives. And people say the same thing about Dougal and the Blue Cat, which is a quite similar children's film from around the same time based on the Magic Roundabout, which kind of holds some weight, except in America, the colours are reversed, aren't they?
Yes, they
are. And there's a lot of American money and American influence in this. So it is just about bad, you know, bad people, bad society in general. They happen to be blue.
Yeah.
So that's that kind of interpretation skewed a bit, but
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get a better underscore for the literal march of the meanies with the hand and that weird one with the fez where his stomach whirls round and so on. Just advancing on Pepperland. And I'm going to say as well, have you heard this and the theme for the League of Gentlemen in the same room at the same time? I think it was a deliberate nod towards this. I mean, I might get an at from Joby Talbot on Twitter telling me I'm completely wrong, but equally, I hope he tells me I'm glad somebody noticed at long last. They are cut from the exact same musical cloth.
They
and
are.
I don't say that in the sense of it was a rip-off of it. I think it was a nod to this really disturbing bit of Yellow Submarine, which is kind of like something out of the League of Gentlemen universe.
Yeah. And track six, George Martin does Dystopia on Pepperland Laid Waste.
Yeah, this is kind of a bleak reworking of the Pepperland theme, which will probably explain why Pepperland wasn't reprised at the end of the film, but obviously we're coming back to that in a second.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting, there are bits of this that sound like Barry Gray's music from the Gerry and Sylvia Anderson series, which again shows that George was paying attention, you know, just... He was somebody who just liked music. I mean, there was that great documentary about when Brian Wilson finally completed Pet Sounds. And they were interviewing all kinds of people going to the premiere, like Natalie Imbruglia for some reason. I can't remember. But people were talking all these high-flown, high-concept ideas about, you know, how the world would have changed if Smile came out and all that. Yeah. And isn't it terrible what they did to Brian? And George Martin really just said, I want to hear it because... I've heard two songs from it. Yeah, he obviously wasn't buying the bootlegs, but you know, he obviously meant Good Vibrations, Heroes and Villains. And he said, they were both marvellous and I want to hear the whole thing.
Yeah.
And, good, you know, Paul was there as well, who obviously appears on the track on Smile, but he kind of said a similar thing just about, I'm not going to do the voice. But
go on.
he was basically saying, you know, I've always wondered what it would have sounded like. And they were the two people who were there at the time that had something to do with it.
Yes.
And so, but with George Martin, it was just music was what he lived and breathed. And it probably would be no surprise that he might have seen Stingray on ITV on a Saturday lunchtime and thought, goodness me, the arrangements in that are quite good.
Yeah.
And well, that, I really think they're echoed in this. And there's some inventive instrumentation as well. Like there's at the end when it starts going into basically the panorama theme, there's that thuddy bit that is like that track from Un Homme et une Femme, which was the theme of Panorama. But over the top, there's a weird percussion instrument, which I think is called the flexitone, which is that thing where the shake it goes like, people might know it if they're kind of a similar vintage to me. It was in the theme music from Jigsaw. Children's BBC puzzle programme. It appears in that quite prominently.
And we have a direct nosy bonk leak.
And equally, Dr. Dre uses it quite a lot as well. Oh. So, it's one of those sounds that, you know, now you just think it's something where when you hear it, you don't take much notice of it. But George clearly thought that needs a flexitone at the end of this to sound a bit weird.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound silly, it sounds a bit spooky. Like, it's like somebody coming behind you going, whoa!
We end with Yellow Submarine in Pepperland.
Yeah, I wonder if this was a leftover from British Maid Stroke by George, because it's the sort of thing you would imagine him doing with Yellow Submarine on that album. And it's a lovely kind of triumphant marching band version of Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
Which signposts, you know, the return of normality to Pepperland and... know, the happy ever after. And like I say, how could John be so scathing about it when he'd done something so wonderful with all of his compositions?
Yeah.
I mean, it's difficult to find very much to say about it. It is just a lovely rendition of Yellow Submarine, but there are some kind of melodic diversions in it.
Oh, and
there's
absolutely
that lovely wistful bit where it goes slower.
Oh, that is absolutely... That piece, that section is genuinely moving. I think his ability, he flits from, like you say, the marching jauntiness and then to that poignant, touching, moving section and then back to playful. But that section you're talking about is heartwarming for me.
And then it ends almost like something from an American presidential rally.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's got that kind of majorettes feel to it.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the album. And
yeah.
It kind of feels almost like that ending is leaving you wanting more.
Yes.
I mean, that was not deliberate on his part. That was just how the cards fell when they put the album together. But
yeah.
In those handful of tracks... It's such a great musical journey, orchestral journey, really, because as you say, it's a 41-piece orchestra. You know, that that is big for, you know, essentially pop music, because this was marketed as a pop album.
Oh,
it wasn't a soundtrack album. It was a full Beatles album. Believe me, as a soundtrack collector, I know it is not regarded as a soundtrack album.
There's a snobbery, is there?
Well, but there is that weird thing of... Bands that did soundtrack albums in the late 60s, they're kind of regarded unfairly as the poor relation of the back catalogue. I mean, you know, people appreciate the Monkey's Head album a lot more, but for years, that was the one, unless you count the later ones where there's like, you know, Mickey Dolenz and possibly David Jones' shoe on them, which didn't resurface for a long time. But Head was the one that took a while to resurface, I think because it sold in such small quantities at the time.
Yeah.
And also, Pink Floyd's two soundtrack albums.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Zabriskie Point one didn't really come out. They had a couple of songs on the soundtrack, and I'm sure they intended to do a full Zabriskie Point album, because it later turned out there were more numbers than that. But they've always been the lower sellers, and I do know that at one point, early on in their career, Blur were looking at scoring a film, and their label boss reminded them that Pink Floyd soundtrack albums had sold, quote, sod all. So, you know, there is
that Clouds is a fantastic album as
it
well.
It is, but how many people do you know who've heard it?
Don't know.
Moore in particular, I think, is the one that's forgotten about. I mean, right at the start of this, I mentioned Relics, which has some tracks from Moore on it.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the extent of what most people know about it. They aren't even the best songs from Moore either. But Yellow Submarine falls into this trap as well, because it's easy to dismiss it as a soundtrack album. It's not a soundtrack album. It's an album with music from a film arranged into two distinct sides.
Yes.
There is more forethought to it than just what was in the film, stick that onto an album.
Yes, definitely.
And I think it should be celebrated more, should be listened to more, and George Martin in particular should be written about more. I mean, there are some great biographies of him, but you occasionally see them on the edge of, you know, sections of books about the Beatles. Well, I don't even know if this happens outside Liverpool, but, you know, you get a rack in Waterstones full of books about the Beatles, and there'll be a George Martin biography just almost sneaking onto the edge.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't particularly recommend All You Need Is Ears, his autobiography, because that kind of, if you've ever heard George being interviewed, it's that on paper again and again. But
it's Kevin Eldon territory.
Yes.
Right. So overall, what would you say to people who've dismissed this, particularly side two?
I would say give it a listen, but give it a listen in between some of your favourite 60s albums or even 60s singles, and you're going to find more common ground than you may have thought there was. It's of a piece with pretty much, I would say, if you like the Beatles and you've gone a bit further in terms of liking 60s music, it sits very well next to a lot of things in your record collection, and that's due to the man pulling the strings in the studio. Literally pulling the strings.
Tim Worthington, thanks so much. It's been a joy.
Thank you for allowing me to talk about this album at long last.
Look at John, will you?
What's the matter, John, love? Blue meanies?
Newer and blue meanies have been sighted within the vicinity of this theatre. Oh. There's only one way to go out.
How's that?
Singing! Oh, get out.